So we'll probably go a little bit out of order with this one, but we'll still use the notes as a guideline. So let's try to get some of these sogos of Pshara down in the time that we have. So in order to do that, let's take a step back and talk first about the general concept of Lifnim Meshuras Hadin, because that's a topic that's worth discussing by itself, worth even considering to be a subtopic, and it's something that we'll refer back to when talking about Pshara. So let's treat that as kind of its own topic in of itself. So the idea of Lifnim Meshuras Hadin is a beautiful concept. It sounds like a great slogan to aspire to, but on the one hand, it's more than a slogan because we find that it's actually a chiyuv. But on the other hand, if you think about it, it's not a simple concept. It is that which is very difficult about it, because, first of all, it's undefined, and almost by definition, right? If we say the law is what's spelled out, so then to go beyond that puts us in uncharted territory, which kind of unmoors us from the whole idea of having a Torah to guide our lives, which doesn't seem to be such a wonderful thing, and also prompts the question that if there is some ideal of Lifnim Meshuras Hadin, so then what's the point of the din? So why don't we just recalibrate the din to match the Lifnim Meshuras Hadin, and what's the point in having a din that we're told, wink, wink, this is not what we're really supposed to be following? And it gets even more complex when we consider the fact that some of the Rishonim actually say that Lifnim Meshuras Hadin is a chiyuv. And it sounds like that from some Gemaras. So then again, the question is all the more so. So if that's really what you are not only encouraged to do, but you have to do, so again, so then what's the point in the law? And then to take it one step further, the Ramah, and very notably this Ramah, is within our sukkah. Ramah is in Hilchos Pshara, and that's probably not a coincidence. The Ramah quotes a few of Rishonim that you can even be kofet on Lifnim Meshuras Hadin, that Beis Din will compel adherence to Lifnim Meshuras Hadin. So now we really have to wonder. So it's one thing to say it's an aspiration. It's another thing to say it's an obligation. It's a third thing to say it's not only an obligation that's a matter of conscience, but we will actually impose it on you. Right, so that's very striking. And Naliach is a discussion in the commentaries on the Ramah. Do we really mean Kiya Mamish in the same way that Beis Din would enforce anything else? Like we spoke about last year, we said Sezubis about Beis Din compelling behavior, is that what we're talking about? Or do we mean something in the middle that Beis Din will firmly express its opinion that Lifnim Meshuras Hadin should be followed, but doesn't necessarily release the dogs in the same way to enforce it? That's a separate question, but in any event, it's certainly noteworthy, this idea that there is some notion of compulsory Lifnim Meshuras Hadin, all of that requires a little bit of explanation. And there's the Gemara Maseches Bava Metzia of the story of Rabbi Bar Rachanan, who was given a psak by Rav because he had workers who caused some problems. The workers damaged his stuff, and he wanted them to pay. And Rav said, in response to their complaints, that they don't have to pay. And when Rabbi said, really? Is that really the law? Dina Hami? And he was told, yes, for you it is. And he quotes the pasuk in Mishlei, Manteilech Biderech Tovim. It should be a good guy, basically. It's pretty much a literal translation. So then, the story goes further, that then it's not enough that they didn't have to pay, but they wanted to get paid for that work that day that they didn't really accomplish too much, and they came complaining to Rav again. And once again, Rav rules in their favor and says they should get paid. To which Rav asks once again, you know how to do that's the did. And he's told yes, and the other half of the pasuk is quoted, V'yorechos tzadikim tishma, that you should follow, preserve the paths of tzaddik. So this sounds like a Lifnim Meshuras Hadin kind of idea, it's basically being presented as an obligation. Now to take a step back, as Tosfos in the second paragraph of Metzia asks, That's an interesting formulation to begin with, because the recourse to a pasuk in Mishlei is surprising, because the truth is we have sources in Chazal that quote Pesukim in Chumash for a chiyuv of the Chumash or a Zimit. And the truth is we really have two candidates. We have, on the one hand, the pasuk in Sefer Dvarim, which the Ramban interprets this way, and which the Gemara sounds like this also, Sisa HaYashar B'Hatov, that we should do that which is straight and that which is good. That's considered to be an obligation. And Ramban says that that includes Lufnim Mishur Sadin. And then there's another pasuk that the Gemara quotes, which is very relevant to our whole year, our whole Masechta. The advice of Yisro to Moshe Rabbeinu, that when Yisro tells Moshe he should set up a hierarchical court system, so he also tells him that this court system should take care of the details, but you have to still teach the big ideas to the Jewish people. Teach them the general values of life. She says, "Vaydaiten esaderech yelchubo v'yas hamasa shayasu." Teach them the path that they should walk on and the action that they should do. Hamasa shayasu. So the Gemara says in Bava Metzia and Bava Kama, both places, the Gemara says, "Maisa ze hadin and asher yasun ze lufnim b'shur said." So apparently there is an obligation of Lufnim Mishur Sadin. So Tosfos asked the question regarding Rabbi Baruch Hanan, so why don't we have that as a source? Why is the Gemara there go to Ksuvin, go to Mishlei, when you can go to Chumash? So Tosfos answers the different types of Lufnim Mishur Sadin. There's Lufnim Mishur Sadin like we often find in, let's say, Shabbos Aveda, where somebody basically agrees to do more than he has to, but it's not really a personal loss. Because, for example, if you return property that you're not obligated to return, so that's a windfall. That would have been a windfall for you to keep this object. So to give it back, okay, you're not losing anything. But in the case of Rabbi Baruch Hanan, so he had to take a loss of broken property that wasn't being compensated. And he then had to pay people for not doing anything. So he's reaching into his pocket. So that doesn't come out as an obligation from the Pesukim and Chumash, and that's why we need to look to Nach as a larger mentality. But in any event, the whole idea remains and is interesting. So on any level, what does it mean to say Lufnim Mishur Sadin as an obligation, as something Bezdin could be kofa on, as anything at all, even as even as an aspiration? How does that fit with a perfect Torah and even a reasonable Torah? What's the point in having two systems? So one way to say it is that really the Lufnim Mishur Sadin represents the behavior that we want, but the Torah has to speak to the lowest common denominator, has to have a standard that everyone can live by. So we need to have two tiers. We need to have a minimalist, and we need also to have a vision of what could be aspired to. So just now, we mentioned this before, but just to insert into our chazaka some forced reverse synergy. So this is evocative of an idea we didn't get to on Thursday. So on Thursday we had Parsha Shir, and we spoke a little bit about the Chi of Talmud Torah, about the Rabbi Schwab's inquiry to Gedolim about how much you have to devote to learning. So this is what the Baruch Be'er responded to him in his Sefer and Kiddushin. So that discussion, if you look at the Baruch Be'er's discussion, you look at others who talk about this, Moshe Feinstein is true about this. Yeah, many suggest that when it comes to Talmud Torah, so we have basically two tiers. That we have, on the one hand, the minimalist obligation of Kriyashma Shachar Sa'ar, this is what the Gemara says, The Gisa Bayom Valayla is a minimalist idea. I learn a little bit in the morning and a little bit at night. And then we have many other Makoros that talk about a much more expansive obligation of Talmud Torah. So the Ar Sameach in Hilchos Talmud Torah has a fascinating essay. It's worth reading. Where he, like everything, it's also worth reading, but he explains that you find this in general in the Torah. It's a common setup that you find in the Torah, that the Torah phrases a mitzvah one way so that it can apply to everyone. And yet, we'll also clue you in to the idea that there's a higher ideal that somebody who's capable of doing more would be advised to try to live up to. And he gives a lot of examples, some very fascinating examples, of where you find this kind of a structure in the Torah. So it could be that that's the simple answer, that we really have one system of din because we need to have a basic minimum, but then we also have another clue that there's more for us to do. Okay. So that could explain it, but there's probably also more to it, and we basically then developed that there's really, beyond that answer, there's two other approaches that give us really two different types of Lefnei Meshuras Hadin. So one is to basically say like this, to basically say that not just the Torah has to speak to the lowest common denominator, but the Torah has to be written in an objective way that's relevant with Doros, that doesn't talk to specifically the fight between Aryeh and Tamir, but refers to Reuven and Shimon in the abstract. That has to be how the Shulchan Aruch is going to be written. So it could be that when we have just the abstract story, so Reuven and Shimon are fighting over something, and this one says that, okay, the din is one way. But the real life fight between Aryeh and Tamir, or real life would never fight, sitting here, so that has other nuances to it, which might require a different attitude. Now, still, you have to figure out, what does that mean? Why should it require a different attitude? So, it could be that the din has details to it, has rules, and those rules are meant to bring about a certain purpose, a certain tachlis. And it's set up so that most of the time these rules will bring up this tapas, will bring about this tapas. But if the scenario is such that that's not really what's happening, that there's some space between the real goal of the mitzvah and what's actually happening, so then the Lefnei Meshuras Hadin means to live up to that. Which is essentially what the Ramban kind of says when he explains Hayashar v'Hatov, saying that the Torah is giving you many, many details of interpersonal relationships to teach you how to be Yashar and Tov. Or he has a very similar statement in his commentary in this week's Parsha, so a little synergy for that point, in Parsha's Kedoshim, that first pasuk in Kedoshim, Ramban says the same idea more in the Ben Adam L'Makom realm, that the Torah is painting a picture with all these details, and the idea is that you're supposed to not only follow the details, but to get the picture as well. So therefore, as some point out, Chazal Lebroid has a comment about this, others make this point, that it's fascinating that we spoke last week when talking about a Siag Dereisa, about the question of when is it legitimate to apply reasons of the mitzvah. Right? The idea of darshan tanda b'kra. So that's the whole discussion in itself, that we know that on the one hand we encourage speculation as to what mitzvahs are meant to accomplish, and the Sefer HaChinuch has that in every mitzvah. I think Rav Tversky Shlita has an article about this in Tradition a few years ago, about the whole concept of the Sefer HaChinuch and elsewhere, considering what the Talmud HaMitzvos are. So normally we relate to that as a part of Torah study, that we want to understand also the theme behind it. But the Gemara tells us that we're limited in terms of applying halacha l'maaseh and saying, well, we could be making on this detail and the like because of how we understand the reasoning of the mitzvah. But what you see here is that maybe there is an actual halachic ramification, that when the mitzvah is carried out, we're not being makel, we followed all the details, but we see there's still a space between the goal of the mitzvah and what's actually happening on the ground. So then, l'fnim mishur sadin means to fill that in. It means that we have to try to fill in that space. So apparently, Gilei Shetiyu and Yashuv HaTov is telling us that there is a mitzvah to figure out what the mitzvah is about, or there's a extra mitzvah at least, to figure out what the mitzvah is about, because if you don't, then how are you going to do l'fnim mishur sadin? Now, that doesn't mean that we have any conclusive answers to these questions. It'll still be speculation. It'll still be speculative. There's still room to argue about what a mitzvah is about. We just had a discussion walking in about what the Kisa Adam is about. It doesn't mean that we know for sure what the answer is, but part of our Avodas Hashem is to try to figure it out to the best of our ability and to work within that type of application. So that's one point of l'fnim mishur sadin. So why is there a gap? There's a gap because in the real world it could happen that all the nuances could make it such. Let's say it was Hashavas Aveda. Hashavas Aveda, the idea is we're supposed to restore the property to people who lost it under normal circumstances, and that there are times when it's no longer considered theirs, you're not obligated. But if the circumstances are such that essentially they really still do have a connection to the item, so then, even if the halacha otherwise could have let you keep it, there's going to be a l'fnim mishur sadin there to give it back. And Hashavas Aveda, look in Shulchan Aruch, look in the commentaries, it's just an area where you find l'fnim mishur sadin cropping up all the time, both in the Gemara and in the commentaries to the Shulchan Aruch, that there are a lot of situations where you might be surprised to find that you're actually patur mishur from returning something. But we're told that l'fnim mishur sadin, you should return. Okay, so that's one type of l'fnim mishur sadin. So we emphasized here, and this is going to, this, the reason we're talking about this now is because this is going to have a big impact on our pshara discussion. So we'll mention this in this context here also, that l'fnim mishur sadin doesn't mean that you just do the opposite of whatever the din is. So, if Josh and I have a machlokas, and the din is that I win, according to Bezdin, so you wouldn't say, okay, l'fnim mishur sadin, Josh wins. Because that's what it means to go l'fnim mishur sadin. You just reverse the din. So, first of all, it doesn't have any svar to it. And second of all, that means the whole Torah is always turned upside down. It doesn't make sense. We'd like to think that the Torah's got it right, so why should we always reverse it? So no, that's not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is that most of the time, so if the Beis Din says I win, I should win. But if there is any way in which there is a more to realize the vision of the Torah, as far as the spirit law is understood, so then if the Mishur Sadin will tell me to address that as well. But it's not just some kind of random flipping of the din. So too, when it comes to our sugi of Pshara, it's not just that we split things down the middle. It's not just that it's a compromise. But rather, it is a psak. This is an idea that Soloveitchik emphasized. It's a psak shel l'fnim mishur sadin. And he understood that to be what Tosfos meant when Tosfos says that, Tosfos quotes the Yerushalmi, that it's a psak shel l'hechru das, that it requires actual das. It's not just a compromise, as they would say in English. So you might think, okay, so if Yoni says I owe him $100, and I say I owe him nothing, so he says, okay, let's compromise, let's make it 50. That's not a pshara. That's splitting down the middle. Anyone could do that. But pshara requires a panel, dayanim, requires an actual process of investigation by qualified people. So that's more than this. That's something that actually factors in the l'fnim mishur sadin components. And we also emphasize in that context, while we're talking about this distinction, that that's also true as far as Kiddush Hashem is concerned. That what we find that halacha is modified mishum Kiddush Hashem.
So that also could be a troubled concept on the surface, that you're saying that, oh, well, the din is one way, but we're embarrassed about it, so we'll do the opposite to impress people, Mishum Kiddush Hashem, and to be very impressive religious. So, presumably, no, that's not what we mean. We mean that when we say halacha is going to be modified, Mishum Kiddush Hashem, it's you have the scenario where the letter of the law is complex, and the spirit of the law is at the core. And the spirit of the law is one that we agree with. But the letter of the law, in this specific scenario, let's say, for example, give Hashem a Sabbath situation. So we believe in returning lost items, that's the core. But there could be a nuance here where the circumstances don't require it. But the Kiddush Hashem consideration is that people are not going to understand that nuance. So they'll think we don't have the value in the first place. They'll say, oh, the Jews, they don't believe in returning lost property. So because that really is a Jewish value, so therefore we're taught in those circumstances to emphasize the value over the details. But if it was really something where it's not a Jewish value in the first place, I don't think we would say that it's a Kiddush Hashem to take that position. Okay. So, with all that, so that's one important angle in terms of what Lefnei Meshuras HaDin is about. There's another type of Lefnei Meshuras HaDin also, which is really different, but could be relevant here too, and that is maybe the din is completely one way, but there's another consideration from elsewhere in halacha that would affect things. So let's say there's a value of Saka or Rachmanis or the like, that's telling us to, practically speaking, take a different path. So that could be a different type of Dimashur Sadin. We mentioned that the Sri Yesha, the Tshuva about this, where he points to a Pasuk in Parshas Mishpatim, which he thinks represents the whole idea, that the Pasuk says that, let's say, you lend money to somebody, and as a mashkon, as collateral, they give you their garment in which they would normally sleep at night. So the Torah says that you have to give it back to him to sleep at night. And describing this, the Torah says that the reason you have to give him back is because, quite simply, what else is he going to sleep in? That's what the Torah basically says. So he doesn't have anything to live with. He's going to feel horrible. And says the Torah, he's going to cry out to me, says God. V'shamayti ki chanunani. God says, I'll be listening. I hope you're listening, but I'll be listening because I am compassionate. So what's going on in that pasuk? Right? So it seems like as far as straight monetary law is concerned, you're allowed to hold on to this item. You lend somebody money, you're entitled to take a mashkon, and you're entitled to hold on to the mashkon until he gives you back the money. But it's simply cruel in this case, because as much as you're entitled, so he's going to be crying and screaming. And therefore, for Rachmanis, you have to give back to him. So this kind of represents this whole idea where you could have the convergence of two different concepts, that this area of halach indeed would not require you to do anything more. But other Jewish values are coming in and saying, take a different path. And apparently that's where you also could have a decision that could end up deviating from the din. So this could also correlate. We basically, Ben just laid out two different types of Lefnei Meshuras HaDin. So this could correlate to a few different ideas. For example, we find that among the criteria that's invoked when we talk about whether to go Lefnei Meshuras HaDin or not, what scenarios do you go Lefnei Meshuras HaDin? So you find sometimes that an Adam Chashuv is encouraged specifically to go with the Meshuras HaDin. And sometimes you find that when the situation is that it's an Asher versus an Ani, if the person, let's say you have a situation where you found lost property that you're entitled to keep, but you are an Asher and the person who lost it is an Ani, so that's when you are very strongly directed to go with the Meshuras HaDin. So this could correlate to these two explanations. That if the idea is an Adam Chashuv, because an Adam Chashuv is somebody who's expected to be living the Torah on a very high
sophisticated, completely in sync levels, they're supposed to understand not just the letter of the law, but also what the law is about. So if that's what he is doing in every other area of Jewish life, so to here, he should be able to recognize that the din really wants him to go further. And the second type, if you are rich and the other guy is poor, so then there's a din of Rahmanis, and Rahmanis is that you should give it back to the guy. So this could have, both of these could be relevant to the case of Rebbe Bar Hanan, when he was told that for him this is the way to act. So on the one hand, he was Tana Chacham, so he should be expected to be more in sync with the values. And also, he was rich and his workers were poor, so he's being told to have rachmanis on them, that yes, they broke your stuff, but you'll survive, and they won't. So that's something to take into consideration as well. It's also interesting because there is a discussion about the concept of a seaboard. Let's say, for example, if you're in charge of a communal institution that runs on public donations, so you might say, okay, I have very strict rules of how to govern such an institution, which is true, and therefore, I don't have the right to go above and beyond. I can only pay the workers, for example, what the din requires, but I can't go beyond because it's not up to me. I'm using public money for this. So that's an understandable attitude, but you find, for the most part, that the postmen who talk about this pretty much across the board say that not only is a public institution allowed to go with the Mishur Sadin, but they must go with the Mishur Sadin. So why is that the case? So that you could also explain based on either of the two models we just mentioned, that in terms of having a fully integrated understanding of halacha, so you could say, listen, any individual may fall short. An individual, by rights, might be one who is just adhering to the letter of the law without an awareness of the spirit of the law. But our communal institutions are supposed to really represent the din. So if the communal institutions aren't living up to the spirit of the law also, then who is? That's really going to be a lack. And secondly, in terms of rich versus poor, so this is hard for us to appreciate in our environment, but the communal institution, we say, ein anias b'tzibur, that even if an institution could be bankrupt or be in major financial tsaros, it's still different than what we talk about when a person is impoverished. That an institution doesn't experience poverty the way an individual does. So if it's a scenario of a human being who's actually suffering from poverty and the institution, then vis-a-vis each other, the institution is really always going to be considered the usher, even if financially they're not in such a secure position. Okay. Yes. I'm talking about other institutions. This is all theoretical. So, in any event, so these are some perspectives on the Mishur Sadin, a very, very important concept because it animates everything that we're all about. But also, it is it's a concept that is a key part of what's going on when we consider Pshara. So now, to get back into the details of Pshara, so we see that, now to look to Aryeh's help here, so we find, really, in the Gemara, two different sugyas of Pshara in our Gemara. One is in our Gemara, in the first part, and hey, the bays, and the other shows up later along the bays and the bays. And there, the Gemara quotes a pasuk, tzedek, tzedek, tirdof. And the Gemara says, two tzedeks, echad adin, v'echad apshara. So the Gemara asks, how do you have apshara? So the Gemara gives a scenario where you have two boats who are about to crash into each other, and you have two camels that are about to occupy the same space in a winding path up a mountain, so they can't both go at the same time. So one has to go before the other, so how are you going to do it? So let's say the boat that's carrying a load goes first, or you'll say the boat that is farther from its destination goes first, whatever it is.
Like we mentioned that time, the story about the Chazanish and Ben Gurion. The Chazanish met Ben Gurion, so he said, okay, we basically have a clash here between two competing interests. We have two boats that are trying to take the same space, but our boat is carrying all the weight of our tradition and our history and all the Torah. So therefore, according to this Gemara, we get to go first. So Ben Gurion would say, well, we don't hold from your Gemara. But then, I don't know what his response was, but that was the Chazanish's line, that this Gemara says we go first. So there, it sounds like it's a chiyuv. And we noted the idea also that it's a chiyuv not only on the dayanim, but perhaps a chiyuv on the individuals to seek out this path and to follow this path. And many of the commentaries on the Chumash and elsewhere point out that we have two different types of pshar. That the pshar in our parish, which we'll talk more about, and we'll see, we may also have to extend this into tomorrow a little bit, but the pshar in our parish is about a situation kind of like what we described, where there's din and there's lifnei mishur hadin, and we're talking about going with lifnei mishur hadin. In the case in Daf Lamed Beis, it's a scenario where there really is no din, that there is no clear halachic decision here who should go first, but there's still a need to keep order, so then Bezdin apparently has a role of that type of tzedek as well, and that's what that Gemara is teaching us. So in any event, so go to the first parak, so we have a sugi of pshara, and we have a back and forth, since apparently in these scenarios din is possible. So is it preferable to do din, or is it preferable to do liftim? Sure, said din. So are it preferable to do pshara? And the Gemara goes back and forth, some kind of in the same sentence, in terms of the word. Is the word called pshara, or is the word called bitsua? And it seems like in most of the context that bitsua has a more negative context. That pshara is when we want to talk about it nicely, and bitsua is when we want to see it in more of a negative light, that's what we're going to use. And there's a back and forth, the pasuk the Gemara quotes, negative about pshara uses the word bitsua. So the Gemara has debate about this, and the Gemara associates the two attitudes with Moshe Rabbeinu and Aaron. That Moshe had an attitude of Yikov Hadin Asahar, that the din should be applied so absolutely that it could pierce the mountain with its straightforwardness, with its rigidity, while Aaron's attitude was Oyev Shalom Verodev Shalom, that he would go back and forth and make sure to bring about peace. And we're told in the rabbinic literature that he would often find people fighting, so he'd go to each one and say, you know, the other guy really wants to make up for you, he just doesn't know how to say it, and maybe you should make the first move, and then he'd say the same thing to the other guy, so then they'd be able to come together and make up. And I think we discussed maybe briefly about whether this is an example of the notion that we discussed a little bit yesterday, of Lashanos Bifnei HaShalom, that we should take the license to fudge things sometimes a little bit, Laman HaShalom. So it's been suggested that actually Aaron wasn't doing that, that really what Aaron was saying is actually the truth. And if you think about it psychologically and socially, it's maybe indeed the case that often people are fighting, and the truth is they really would rather be not fighting, they really do want to make Shalom, but their ego or their pride is in the way, or whatever else it is, or awkwardness is in the way, stopping them from making that first step. So the truth is, who says Aaron is lying? I mean, maybe he's actually going to the core of what's really the case. But in any event, so these are the two different attitudes that Gemara talks about, and so we have a back and forth, but ultimately we conclude that pshara is a good idea. Okay, so then we discussed that Tosfos has an idea which a lot of Rishonim agree. You could probably find a minority opinion that disagrees, but practically speaking, this was a very broadly held opinion among the Rishonim. It's actually significant whether it's unanimous or not, because it's about the subject of unanimity. That Tosfos holds
that even though we say makshinin pshara l'din, even though we assume that there is linkage between pshara and din for certain purposes, but not for everything. And one major difference is that when it comes to din, we follow rov, and when it comes to pshara, so we don't follow rov. And you have to have a unanimous psak for pshara. So the question is, why is that? Why is that the case? So we mentioned a number of explanations as to why it should be. A lot of these were in the Shirim of Soloveitchik and elsewhere. So some of them you rejected, but the rejected ones are also useful in terms of framing things. So the first that he rejected was to illustrate this point that I made a few minutes ago, that you might think, all right, that pshara is basically not really the din, and it is the Bezdin imposing kind of a settlement. So therefore, it requires it's not a psak, it's really a maisa Bezdin, like you find the Bezdin in general having a dual role, sometimes to clarify something and sometimes just to sign off on something. So here they're signing off on it, so that has to be unanimous. So the Rav said, he doesn't think that that could be, this is not just them splitting things down the middle, like you said, this is an actual evaluative process, and therefore that's not going to explain why we wouldn't follow Rove. You also mentioned a possibility, which you also rejected, but this one others thought there was more to, that maybe you could say that because it's not obligatory for the Balei Din to take up Shara, so therefore you need to have Rov, because they basically say that we're not going to take this deal unless it's unanimous. So therefore, you need a unanimous Bezdin in order to give them the ruling that they'll accept. So this is something Moshe Sternbuch discusses. Rav Soloveitchik ultimately rejects this approach as well. Sternbuch suggests in his tshuva that maybe it depends on whether they said that it should be a pshara krov l'din or not, a pshara krov l'din, a stam pshara. So that's an interesting point here. Soloveitchik, in general, not only didn't accept this approach here, but the whole concept, this is something that the Shachter points out in a few places, that the Rav rejected the whole idea of Pshara HaKrov L'Din, because all Pshara is Krov L'Din, and that's the idea that the Pshara is supposed to be built on the principles that make up the Din, the principles of Afnim Mishur Sadin, so we don't have these two different systems of Pshara and Pshara HaKrov L'Din. Hadoff the Presses, just so you take a look, is Rabbi Willig Shlita has a new sefer, Am Mordechai, on Dalat Chalkei Shulchan Aruch, and just looking at briefly, I won't try to say it over because it's very complicated, but for your extra edification, I would recommend taking a look at it. So he has a two-page piece, it's so complicated, but it's only two pages, on Pshara. And there, he quotes from various sources that he essentially notes it's really a machlokes achronin, whether we hold from this distinction or not, of pshara, krov l'din, and pshara, and he says, like we just said just now, that the Rav rejected any such distinction, and he discusses nafkaminas, of whether there should be or shouldn't be a distinction, and notes where you see the distinction in other achronin, and discusses how that would affect the nature of the pshara. So for extra edification, if you want to take a look, it's just hot off the presses now, still not available. I'm Mordechai and Dalat Chalkei Shulchan Aruch. There's an essay about this. Okay, but in any event, so that's not going to work for the Rav because he didn't like it. So then there was really two more approaches. It was phrased as ones. Really, let's say there are four approaches total. The third approach that the Rav did like was that Rov is used when you're trying to establish a point of halacha l'daros. So they're saying that the halacha practically, as should be recorded in Shulchan Aruch, as should be recorded in the Rambam, is such and such, assuming this was happening before the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch were written down, so then Rov is going to be Mahriya on that, an abstract halacha. But when you're dealing with not abstract halacha, but the nuances of a scenario in front of you, so then there's no chiddush of Rov. Rov was not introduced into such a situation. So this explanation, in addition to being consistent with the Mishra Sadin idea, is also good for us because this works well with what we said a few minutes ago in talking about how the Mishra Sadin works. Right, you may recall that one of the things we said a few minutes ago was that the difference between Din and Lefnei Mishur HaSadin is that Din is written for Reuven and Shimon, and Lefnei Mishur HaSadin is written for Aryeh and Tamir. So it's one thing to say, all right, we'll follow Rov when we're trying to figure out the rules for Reuven and Shimon, the Doros, we follow Rov. But when we're trying to figure out this scenario and factoring all of Lefnei Mishur HaSadin factors, so then Rov doesn't have a place. And that's essentially the hesber that the Rav liked. There is another hesber which is really different, but it's somewhat similar to this point about the limitations of Rov. And we mentioned it yesterday because it came up in another context, the context of Dayan Shein Yodea, and it's consistent also with Yosef Engel. Again, a record number of mentions in one semester, so Yosef Engel, and it's based on Otzer. I think we also invoked him from at least three different Svarim. So we mentioned Lakach Tov at length, we mentioned Tshuvas Ben Poras yesterday. So when it's based on Otzer, he has an essay about this, where he says that Rov and Bittel only work when you have a real clash, like we discussed yesterday about the Roshiation material, and the Dayan says, I don't know. But if you have one guy saying Zakai and two other Dayanim saying Chayiv, okay, so that's a real clash, and there is Bittel. But if you have details of Apshara, and they're both trying to figure out how to work out the pratim of a situation where there's elements of chi and elements of tur, so you don't have a real clash there for Bittel to work, and therefore Rov is not nash. All right, I think we'll stop here. So our agenda for tomorrow is pretty packed. Probably again, stay tuned, but she will be maybe a drop earlier. We're probably about the same time. And we have to do parsha, say a little bit more about Shara, and talk also about Musa Guru's name. All right, I wish you all a wonderful day.